Captain Penrod Ballantyne had been waiting in the antechamber of Her Britannic Majesty's consulate in Cairo for 48 minutes. He checked the time on the clock above the door to the inner office to the Consul General. On the left-hand side of the massive carved door hung a life-sized portrait of Queen Victoria, as she had been on her wedding day, pure and pretty, with the bloom of youth still on her and the crown of empire on her head. On the opposite side of the door there was a matching portrait of her consort, Albert of Saxe-Coburg and Gotha, handsome and marvellously bewhiskered. Penrod Ballantyne shot a glance at himself in the gilt-framed ceiling-high mirror that adorned the side wall of the antechamber, and with satisfaction noted his own likeness to the young prince consort, now long dead, while Penrod was young and vital. The captain's epaulettes on his shoulders and the frogging of his uniform jacket were bright new gold. His riding boots were polished to a glassy sheen, and the fine glove leather creased around his ankles like the bellows of an accordion. His cavalry sabre hung down along the scarlet side stripe of his riding breeches. He wore his dolman slung over one shoulder and clasped at his throat with a gold chain, and carried his hussar's bearskin busby under his right arm. On his left breast he wore the purple watered silk with the bronze cross inscribed "For Valour," which had been cast from the Russian guns captured at Sebastopol. There was no higher military decoration in the Empire. Sir Evelyn Baring's secretary came in. "The Consul General will see you now." Penrod had been standing to preserve the pristine appearance of his uniform. Creases at the elbows, down the back of his tunic, and at the knees of his breeches were unsightly. He replaced the tall busby on his head, glancing in the mirror to make certain it was centred low on his eyebrows with the chain across the chin, then marched through the carved doors into the inner office. Sir Evelyn Baring was seated at his desk reading from a sheath of dispatches in front of him. Penrod came to attention and saluted. Baring beckoned him in without glancing at him. The secretary closed the door. Sir Evelyn Baring was officially the agent of Her Britannic Majesty's government in Egypt and her consul general in Cairo with plenipotentiary powers. In truth, he was the viceroy who ruled the ruler of Egypt, since the Khedive had been saved from the mobs of rebellion by the British army and the fleet of the Royal Navy in Alexandria Harbour. Egypt had become, in all but name, a British protectorate. The Khedive Tawfiq Pasha was a weak youth and no match for a man like Baring and the mighty empire he represented. He had been forced to abdicate all his powers, and in return the British had given him and his people the peace and prosperity they had not known since the age of Pharaoh Ptolemy. Sir Evelyn Baring possessed one of the most brilliant minds in the colonial service. The Prime Minister, William Gladstone, and his cabinet were aware of and highly appreciative of his qualities. However, towards his underlings, his manner was patronising and condescending. Behind his back, they called him Sir Overbearing. Now he ignored Penrod as he went on with his reading, making notes in the margins with a gold pen. At last he stood up from his desk and left Penrod standing while he went to the windows that overlooked the river to Giza and the stark silhouettes of the three mighty pyramids on the far bank. "That damned idiot," Baring mused to himself. "He's got us into this pretty pickle of rotten fish." From the outset, he had opposed the appointment of Chinese Gordon. He had wanted to send Sam Baker, but Gladstone and Lord Hartington, the Secretary of War, had overruled him. It is in Gordon's nature to provoke conflict. The Sudan was to be abandoned. His job was to bring our people out of that doomed land, not to confront the mad Mahdi and his dervishes. I warned Gladstone precisely this. Gordon is trying to dictate terms and force the Prime Minister and the Cabinet to send an army to reoccupy the Sudan. If it were not for the unfortunate citizens that he has incarcerated with him, and for the honour of the Empire, we should let Chinese Gordon stew in his own juice. As Baring turned away from the window in the contemplation of those immemorial monuments across the Nile, his eye fell on a copy of the Times of London that lay on the table beside his favourite armchair. He frowned more deeply. "And then we have also to take into account the uninformed and sentimental opinions of the sweating masses, so readily manipulated by those petty potentates of the press." He could almost recite the leading article from memory. We know that General Gordon is surrounded by hostile tribes and cut off from communication with Cairo and London. Under these circumstances, the House has the right to ask Her Majesty's government whether they are going to do anything to relieve him. Are they going to remain indifferent to the fate of the one man on whom they have counted to extricate them from these dilemmas, to leave him to shift for himself and make not a single effort on his behalf? Was what Lord Randolph Churchill had said to the Commons, as reported on the 16th of March, 1885. Damned demagogue, Baring thought now, and looked up at the hussar captain. Ballantyne, I want you to go back to Khartoum. He spoke directly to Penrod for the first time since he had entered the room. Of course, sir, I can leave within the hour, Penrod responded. He knew that the one word the master of Egypt liked to hear above all others was yes. Baring allowed himself a wintry smile, an extraordinary mark of his approval. His intelligence system was wide-reaching and pervasive. Its roots burrowed into every level of Egyptian society, from the highest levels of the government and the military to the forbidden councils of the mullahs in their mosques and the bishops in their cathedrals and Coptic monasteries. He had his agents in the palaces of the Khedive and the harems of the pashas, in the souks, bazaars and brothels of the greatest cities and the meanest villages. Penrod was nothing but a tiny tadpole in the festering swamp of intrigue in whose waters Sir Evelyn Baring set his lines and into which he cast his net. However, recently he had become quite fond of the lad. Behind the good looks and dandified appearance, Baring had detected a bright, quick mind and an attention to duty that reminded him of himself at the same age. Penrod Ballantyne's family connections were solid. His elder brother was a baronet and had large estates on the Scottish borders. He himself had a significant income from a family trust, and the purple ribbon on his chest bore ample witness to his courage. Moreover, the young dog had shown a natural aptitude for intelligence work. Indeed, he was gradually and subtly making himself valuable, not indispensable, for nobody was that, but valuable. The only possible weakness that Baring had so far detected in him, he carried in his trousers. "I will give you no written message for the usual reasons," he said. "Naturally, sir." "There is one message for General Gordon and another for David Benbrook, the British consul. The messages are not to be confused. It may seem to you that they are contradictory, but pray do not let that trouble you." "Yes, sir." Penrod divined that Baring trusted Benbrook well enough because he lacked brilliance, just as he trusted Chinese Gordon not at all because of his brilliance. "This is what you are to convey to them." Baring spoke for half an hour without consulting any slip of paper, barely pausing to draw breath. "Have you got that, Ballantyne?"
"I have, sir."
"One of the fellow's assets is his appearance," Baring thought. "No one can readily believe that behind those whiskers and those wonderfully pleasing features is a mind that can assimilate such a lengthy, complicated message at the first recital, then deliver it accurately a month later." "Very well," he said flatly. "But you must impress on General Gordon that Her Majesty's government has no intention whatsoever of reconquering the Sudan. The British army now making its way up the Nile is in no way an expeditionary force. It is not an army of reoccupation. It is a rescue column of minimal strength. The objective of the desert column is to insert a small body of regular first-line troops into Khartoum to bolster the defences of the city long enough for us to evacuate all our people. Once this has been achieved, we intend to abandon the city to the dervish and come away."
"I understand that, sir."
"As soon as you have delivered your messages to Benbrook and Gordon, you are to return northwards and join Stuart's relief column. You will act as guide, lead him across the bight of the Nile to where Gordon's own steamers are waiting at Metemma, to take them upriver. You will attempt to keep in contact with me. The usual codes, mind."
"Of course, Sir Evelyn."
"Very well, then. Major Adams of General Wolseley's staff is waiting for you on the second floor. I understand that you are acquainted with him."
"I am, sir."
Of course, Baring knew that Penrod had won his V.C. by rescuing Samuel Adams from the bloody battlefield of El Obeid. "Adams will give you a more detailed briefing and provide you with the passes and requisitions you will need. You can catch the Cook steamer this evening and be in Aswan by Tuesday noon. From there, you are on your own. How long to Khartoum, Ballantyne? You've made the journey many times before." It depends on conditions in the desert of the Mother of Stones. If the wells are holding, I can cut the great S bend of the river and reach Khartoum in 21 days, sir, Penrod answered crisply. 26 at the outside. Baring nodded. Make it 20 rather than 26. Let yourself out. Baring dismissed him without offering to shake hands. He was lost in his dispatches again before Penrod reached the door. It was not important to Baring that people liked him, only that they did their job.